This is tape number one, side number one, on Monday, January 22nd, 1990, in Pittsburgh. This is a Pittsburgh section of the National Council of Jewish Women Oral History. And this is Harold Kimball and Howard Braun interviewing Mel Seidenberg at his home. Will you give us your name and address and the date of birth, please?
My name is Mel Seidenberg, 101 Elmore Road, Forest Hills, Pennsylvania. My date of birth was November 22nd, 1915.
Well, Mr. Seidenberg, we'll start with your background, beginning with your childhood. For example, where were you born, what place was it in the year, and how did you come to Pittsburgh?
I was born in 1915 in Pueblo, Colorado, where my folks had migrated to from Poland and Russia. Came to Pittsburgh in 1946, June 1946, to take a job with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
That long ago.
Yeah.
Would you like to tell us something about your parents? Why did they pick Pueblo, Colorado, of all places in the United States?
Well, my mother was born and raised in Poland. She came here on this country when she was about 18 to New York, worked in the sweatshop. She had an older sister in Colorado who had little money, and her sister got her out to Colorado. My father was a bartender and had kind of bummed around the country, St. Louis, came to Denver for his asthma. Saw a picture of my mother, wanted to meet her, met her, and they settled in Pueblo, where he opened up a little grocery store. Worked in the steel mills there, which was like, Pueblo was like little Pittsburgh. He opened up a little grocery store, and then I came along.
Well, how was it living in that little town? Or how long
Pueblo,
did you live there?
Pueblo, I was lived there, you know, first part of my life. Pueblo was not a little town. Colorado was at that time was what, a city of about 60,000, but it was a steel railroad center, and it was a hub of southern Colorado. It was the second largest city to Denver, so it wasn't a small town. It was much like Pittsburgh, with many steel workers and whatnot, and it was a rough town. It had been a rough western town, and it was... There were hard times there. We had a flood that wiped out the city in 1921 when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And my father had a business that prospered for a while. And then when the mills and the Depression came along, and he had many of his customers were steel workers, Mexican steel workers in that town, and couldn't pay their bills, so he lost his grocery store.
Grocery store, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so he lost the store then. But I went to grade school. I was the only Jewish kid in the grade school I went to. Was running for my life most of the time. And then to high school, where I became, when I was about a freshman or sophomore, I became interested in doing sports. I wrote high school sports for the daily paper there, the Pueblo Star Journal. And continue with that, played a lot of sports myself, and then went on to about a year and a half of a year and a couple months of college at the University of Oklahoma, and ran out of money. And this is in the 1930s, of course, Depression years, and went to work, got a job in Cherokee, Oklahoma, for a semi-weekly paper, the Cherokee Messenger and Republican, twice a week. And I was 19 years old. I was a whole staff. I was the editor and staff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And worked there for about 6 or 7 months. Came back to Pueblo. The editor, I was getting $15 a week.
What year was that when you came back to Pueblo?
That was about 1936, I guess. And the editor of this little paper, the owner of this paper, felt that I was getting too much money. I was getting $15 a week. So he had to get some local person who would work for less. So I came back to Pueblo, worked in shoe stores and did a few things, and then went to work for the Pueblo Chieftain on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And that was a morning paper, and worked nights for until 1941, when the war came along, and then I, when right after Pearl Harbor, I and two of my buddies on the paper that I worked with, all three enlisted in the Marines. About it was 2 days after Pearl Harbor, and all of us were rejected because our chest measurements were about a half inch too small.
Yeah.
That was before the Marines let down their standards a little.
Yeah.
So about 2 weeks later, I enlisted in the Navy. And went into the Navy and wound up in Pearl Harbor in March of 42, and stayed and was in Hawaii for about 28 months at the Naval U.S. Naval Hospital there.
Let me ask you this before we go further: how was it in your native city? What was the population of the Jews? Did they have a synagogue?
It was. It had a sizable Jewish community, a very close-knit Jewish community. They used to measure it in terms of about 100 families or 125 mm-hmm. families. There was a Orthodox shul and there was a Reformed temple.
And which each, were you?
Well, my folks belonged to the shul, and it was in a sort of rundown part of town, and it was a... I wasn't all that religious, but I, you know, I went to please my mother, and tried to figure out ways to always get out of going and
going where to
the
shul.
Oh, and then I had to go to Cheder.
Did you go to Cheder?
And I didn't get bar mitzvah because the rabbi and I didn't get along too well, and I was.
You had preparation and you went through and then you didn't follow up.
It didn't make sense to me that I wasn't learning any of the English. I was just learning the
how to say it. What happened to all of us? And, we never learned the English.
Yeah,
right?
And this rabbi was nameless Goodman. I remember he was very kind of mean, I think. He used to hit us, you know, bang us on the hand and so forth.
Right.
We threw rocks at him. And I felt justified because he later left town. He had some of the shul's money when he left town.
How about that? But was there much anti-Semitism there?
Well, there was, I was aware of it later when I was about the third, fourth, fifth grade, and I went to a school called Hinsdale, which was a very tough school. Mm. Irish, Anglo-Saxon kids, Italian, and I was the only Jewish kid, as far as I know, in the school, and I got beat up a lot for that until I became made good friends with two great big black guys that became my lifelong friends. One of them later became a professional boxer, and after they became my friends, I solved that problem. But in high school, I didn't really encounter. There was a country club set, and there was a But most of the merchants in that city were Jewish, you know, of course, and there were very few Jews, as was true in Pittsburgh, I think, working in the steel mills, the railroads, but they were in business there.
Yeah.
And there was a section called Union Avenue, which is now a historic district. I was just there in last June. And at that time, it was sort of like... lower upper Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh, back in the old days when it had Jewish, my father's grocery store, he carried for a time kosher meats and delicatessens, and then there was a lot of used furniture store and new furniture store and clothing and pawn shops, and all of those were Jewish owned. The barber shop, the pool hall, they were all, as I remember, Jewish owned. And this whole street was there near the railroad station, and this whole street was about three blocks was mostly Jewish-owned streets. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of Mexicans in the city, so I don't know whether how deep the anti-Semitism. I don't think it was as bad there as it was in some other places, and the community developed there, Jewish community, because Denver had developed a sizable Jewish community, because a lot of people went out there for their health. The large, the national Jewish tuberculosis home was located there, and a lot of people went there for that reason.
Well, how many miles was this town from Denver?
Just 120 miles south.
Not too far.
Yeah.
And there was a sizable Jewish population. Did any of those Jews amount to anything, that is, monetarily?
Oh, some. Mm-hmm. Yes, some became quite
wealthy. Really?
Yes, there were some lawyers and
Wait.
You want me to wait? Or?
No, it's okay.
Go ahead. A
couple of the jewelry stores.
They became wealthy?
There were some fairly well-to-do. There were some quite well-to-do people there. And there was a section of Pueblo called the East. It was on the east side. It was like a shtetl in Russia. It was at dirt streets. And right. That's where I had my uncle and his family lived there. He didn't. He was came out of the Russian army. He was a... He deserted the Russian army and came to his country, and he was a worker, and he worked in the junkyard, which he later came to manage. But this section he lived in, my cousin and I have just been working on a family history, which we can't recount all this until she unfortunately died this year. But where they lived were a number of Jewish families. When I was very young, we lived there before my father had the grocery store, because he had a horse and wagon he peddled. And there was a shechet there, and there was a guy, I used to have to take the chickens to be killed and all. Right. And it was there were some Italians and some Mexicans in the neighborhood, but it was Jewish, and as I remember, the streets were mostly dirt, and it was... there was a couple little stores there, Jewish stores.
How did your father get himself up from peddling to...
Well, he, I think my aunt, who had married a man that owned a furniture store and he was fairly well to do, and she always never knew him, never heard him refer to him as anything but Sikovsky. That was his last name. I never knew his first name until recently, until we were researching. And so I think she helped my father. She probably loaned him money to get stuff. It was a very small grocery store at the beginning near the. Near the railroad station, near the Arkansas River, wiped out totally by the 1921 flood. But he had stashed money away in a can on the shelf. And I remember going in there with him in the mud, and there were dead cows and dead horses and dead pigs. And he found the money in this can that he'd stashed away. We lived behind the store, and I remember that little place, one room, and I don't even know if we had, I don't remember where the bathroom was. We didn't have a bath. It was a toilet and a sink. But it was always cheerful. My mother just had a way of making it cheerful. And then he got a larger store, and we lived behind that till I was about, I guess till about the fourth or fifth grade, and then we moved to a house uptown.
And what influenced you to move? That is, what influenced your family to move, and where did you move to?
To where? You mean in Pueblo?
How did you come to Pittsburgh?
How did I come to Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
Well, I
thought... Did the family remain in...
Oh, my father and my mother both remained there.
Oh,
and,
I see.
And both died there.
But and, you...
Well, I left Pueblo to go into the Navy.
That's right.
And I had been wanting to get out because I was in newspaper work, and it was limited opportunities in Pueblo, so I had been... trying to figure out some way to get out, and then the war came along, so I went in the Navy, and most of the time in the Navy, I was in the Navy, I was doing some kind of writing with using a typewriter and doing.
What year was that?
I went in the Navy in March of 42, right after Pearl Harbor, and I was in there until fall of 45. My last year of the Navy, I came to Washington. I was at the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery and doing writing, handling news releases. We would come from combat correspondence, from Marine combat correspondence. Mm-hmm. And at the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery, I met my wife's brother, Vic, who was editor of the Hospital Quarterly, and he was writing speeches for Admiral McIntyre, who was President Roosevelt's personal physician. And so I got to know him, and he asked me to come out for dinner, and that was, I met my wife, and so we got married there, and then after the war ended, I went back to Pueblo for a few months to help my father out. My father and mother had to go to Mayo Clinic, and in the meantime, an offer came. I stopped in Pittsburgh for an interview, because my brother-in-law knew somebody at the Post Gazette. I had an interview, and then a few months later, I got a letter to come to work. And so I came June 46. I came to Andy Bernhardt, the editor of the Post Gazette, hired me.
So you came here with your wife, right?
Yes.
About what year was that?
I was in June of 46. There was a real shortage, housing shortage here.
What was Pittsburgh like then?
Well, we came here and, you know, it was a job to me and it was what I wanted. But Pittsburgh was, I said, well, we can't stay here very long because I had allergy problems close to asthma and the smoke was just, you know, the smoke and the pollution. And it was an interesting city, but you couldn't see, you know, you couldn't see most of it. You know, it was it was awful. I said, how are we going to... And the housing shortage was bad then, right after the wars. We lived at the Pittsburgh Hotel for about a month and finally found a little attic out in Wilkinsburg. And,
wow, of all places.
Yeah. Wilkinsburg was pretty pretty anti-Semitic at
that
time.
Yes, it was.
And, but it was... it was an interesting city to be a newspaper reporter in those days because in 46, 47, 48, you were having all of the, it was a national center for labor negotiations, U.S., and you know, the steel workers and all of that,
right.
And the coal miners, and it was very interesting from the point of view of me learning, you know, to do cover stories.
Yeah.
We had a big power strike that lasted for, I don't know how long, it was a couple months. And, you know, the city was blacked out, and so there was, Pittsburgh was a very good news town at that time, right after the war. So that kept me there, and I was busy on general assignment.
Which part did you live in Wilkinsburg then?
We lived in Wilkinsburg, and then we moved into a little better, couple of rooms in Wilkinsburg on Trenton Avenue, and about 1950s, in the early 50s, we moved to Sproul Hill. We lived on Whiteman, right there at Hobart.
Yeah.
And we had a nice apartment there.
Then
in 52, our first child, our son, was coming along, so we bought this house out here after we were trying to find a, desperately, we wanted to stay in the city, but we couldn't find anything we could afford with a yard and so forth, and this house, and we've been here this ever since. Now we're trying to find a way to move back in the city.
In 52, moved to the present.
Yeah, yeah. We're looking at apartments in the city, condos.
Well, this is a beautiful spot. I never knew the street was here.
Well, we've liked it. We raised three kids in this little house. Uh-huh. And I don't know how we did it, but we did.
Well, it's nicer. It feels like the country.
Yeah, well, a lot of forest, you know, there is a lot of trees, but trouble is the developers are slowly getting them out of
it. Encroaching you.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, did you find this neighborhood, did you join, is there a Jewish group in this neighborhood? What's it
we were one of the, we were probably one of the few, or maybe one of the, I know we were the first Jewish people on this street, and most of Forest Hills was non-Jewish.
Right.
Very few. Later on, people came, within a few years, people from Pitt and Westinghouse, and there's quite a few Jewish people out here now. But at that time, we were pretty much about the only ones, I think.
So there's no local synagogue or temple or anything that makes a community supported thing.
No, not in Forest Hills.
What do you do for your Jewishness? Did you join anything or become active in anything?
Well, we belong to the young people's for a while, but I have just never been, neither one of us has been very religious.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel we have a strong Jewish identity. We we identify very strongly with that, but not in a religious sense.
Mm-hmm. Regarding young people's, when do you remember?
About...
when Paul Cohen was too.
Well, actually, we joined Joe Schwartz and his wife lived out here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know Joe Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through with them. And we were, I don't know, probably in the 60s.
Right. Well, for your children, were they bar mitzvah?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Is this...
They went for a while. But
the organization in Squirrel Hill on Forbes, the... Young people.
Hebrew Institute.
Institute. I know where I got.
Where, you know where that's located?
Yes. Yeah, it's on Forbes and Denniston.
Forbes and Denniston. Yeah, I know exactly where it is. So you went from here, and that was your relationship.
A little bit, right.
Yeah.
In the early 60s. We didn't, children
are yeah.
not bisexual.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else?
Well, our son was not bisexual. He'd be a musician. He was into other things. And our two daughters were not oriented to that.
Mm. We have son and two daughters, which we hadn't mentioned before.
Right. So, you were active during this whole period with the Post-Gazette, right?
From 1946 until 1962, I was with the Post-Gazette.
Well, when you left in 62, did you retire, or did you go somewhere else?
No, in the early 50s, I'd done general assignment for the Post-Gazette, you know, writing all kinds of stories, and little by little, Pittsburgh was starting its so-called big renaissance, mm-hmm. and I was getting more and more involved with that, and writing quite a bit about that, and highways, and transit, and all that was big news then, still is to some extent. And so I became start specializing in that, and became known as a Renaissance writer, and also real estate editor. And so I handled real estate, and my prime activity was in covering stories and that had to do with the example of the Point, the Gateway Center, the redevelopment of downtown. East Liberty, North Side, the stadium, and I got very much involved with that. Meanwhile, writing a real estate column, and in that I was concerned with fair housing and fair employment. And in fact, I think I may have been possibly the first to really do much writing on the inequalities, the inequities in housing at that time, and trying to open up the, people were, there was a group, Mrs. Florence, you remember Florence Reisenstein?
Oh, sure.
They were working to get some integrated housing developments and stuff. So I did a lot of writing on that subject, and we became quite interested. So this developed into a beat, as we call it in this paper, urban renewal, highways, the parkway was being built in it, and the Port Authority Transit was a big item, because that was developing, and anything related to that. So I kind of stuck with that pretty much, except for an interim period in the about 1956, 57, when I took out, spent about 6 or 8 months working under the sponsorship of the Post Gazette and WWSW, which the Post Gazette owned then, and Herbig & Held Printing, with a documentarist named Roy Stryker, and we worked on a
Roy
Stryker, Stryker, who was pretty well known as a documentarist for Tari, done a lot of work, exhibits for Standard Oil. And we put out a book called The Pittsburgh Album. I can show it to you if you want, a little pictorial history. Yeah. And I became at that time, during that period, I did got into that because I had done 200 years of chronology for Stefan Lorentz's book, Pittsburgh. You've seen that. The big one. He has his third or fourth edition.
Right.
The chronology that I did, basic, is in there. So from that, I got into this thing for this Pittsburgh album. Got quite interested in Pittsburgh history, and especially the changes that were taking. The changes were very dramatic. One of the things that kept us here in Pittsburgh was by 1950, 51, 52, we were seeing some changes here. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you lived here then, but the air was clearing up,
right.
The smoke, when they got the locomotives changed to diesels,
right.
and
you couldn't use coal.
Yeah, that was
in
that
your
was
furnace,
a big, yeah,
right?
Yeah, that was Dave Lawrence that really led
to
the leadership there, and then it spread the county.
Right.
He provided the leadership, and the city came first. People had to convert either to gas or convert their furnace so that it would use smokeless fuel, and then the county came. And that made a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
So today we're battling, both my wife and I are interested in still pollution. We both members mm-hmm. of GASP, Group Against Smog and Pollution.
Right.
And we're very much in support of the Sierra Club. And so now we're battling pollution that we didn't know existed there then.
Well, during
then it was just smoke, you know. Yeah. But you still had all the other, you know, we have the toxic waste and the chemicals.
Right. But during this whole period, was Block the owner of the Post-Gazette?
Well, Bill Block, he's about the same age as I, and he came into the Post-Gazette as associate publisher. And after he and his brother, Paul,
right.
Paul ran the blade. They were co-publishers, I guess. And their father had died. Of course, their father had owned the Blade, Toledo Blade, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and he owned a couple of other papers. He was one time very much associated with Hearst. He bought a lot of properties for Hearst.
Oh, really? Was he Jewish?
Paul Block, yes.
Yeah.
And Bill
his
Block,
father was Jewish.
Well, but Paul Block was the father, and then he had a son,
see.
Paul Jr., and
yeah.
Bill Block. And Bill Block then became, and he was very supportive and very liberal, I think, in his,
really?
He allowed me and he and the city editor, Joe Schumann, gave me quite a bit of flexibility in what I was writing, particularly about racial inequality.
Yeah.
And even though the advertising department used to worry, like at that time, Post-Gazette had an advertising, they don't have it now. But they used to worry every week about what I was going to write because the real estate people were getting upset.
Yeah.
But
too liberal,
but,
right?
But well, they were getting ads from the real estate people, and the real estate people were getting mad because of some of the things. And it was bad here. This was a very segregated city. You know, we saw that.
You mean there were places where Jews could not rent or buy
Jews
homes,
and, well,
right?
Well, I was writing about blacks particularly, but there were Jews too. We found
sure.
it. We knew that personally when we, there were sections of the city, that section like Shenley Heights,
right.
A Jew could not. We
That's
tried
right.
up there. Shenley Farms. We
right.
tried to get an apartment there. We couldn't. We tried to buy a house in Mount Lebanon when they found us, our name taken off
right.
the market. So Jews, but it was worse for blacks because blacks at that time were confined pretty much to the Hill District,
mm-hmm.
and then they started moving out to Homewood. But the Hill District was, you know, pretty much in some parts of the North Side.
Mm-hmm.
But it was segregation was very, very strong then. It's pretty well broken down, I think, now. As far as Jews are concerned, it's
yes.
broken down all the way, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
There's still some, but I think it's, there aren't, for example, Forest Hills does not have many, has a few black families, but not
mm-hmm.
many. But
and they didn't have Jews at all in Forest Hills, did they?
I don't think there were any before we came.
No.
There were, when we lived in Wilkesburg, there had to be some, because there was a small shul there.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, right behind us on the hill up here, there's a
really?
Little small a Jewish cemetery.
That's right.
I don't know if it's still in. If,
yes,
it is. It's, I have the name written up. Forget the.
Whose auspices was?
Well, it was under. There used to be a lot of small congregations, Turtle Creek, East Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
Braddock.
Right.
All of them had their own little shuls.
Yeah.
And the guy that's left from all of those have gone, because the shows have closed up. But the guy, what's his name? I have his name written down.
He's in B'nai B'rith active.
Yeah, he still kind of keeps an eye. And his son is in a big law firm.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of his name, because that's where the phone, you want to reach him. Mm-hmm. The phone calls go to his son's office. But I think there's a Jewish cemetery in Monroeville where my mother-in-law is buried, and there's one. I think when those cemeteries were established, the land was cheap. You know, there was
right.
it was open or coal mining or farming, and it's you know suburban developments have grown up around those cemeteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, closed in on them.
Yeah,
that happened to Temple Sinai. Are you familiar with Temple Sinai?
Temple Sinai manages the one in, or they had something to do with the one in Monroeville. That,
right.
Or Plum Borough it is, I guess.
Yeah, Plum Borough.
Yeah.
Anyhow, the city just came up to the edges of that cemetery today.
Yeah.
Whereas when they first bought the land, there was nothing there but farms. And I guess that happened everywhere,
yeah.
right?
Well, that the one over there in the South Hills, right up off of Sawmill Run, that's where
yeah.
Paul Cohn was buried. And we were there, you know, when he died. And that...
Where was Paul buried?
Forgotten the name. It's right up off of from Sawmill Run. Boy, you take a turn shortly after you come out of the tunnels, and it's up there near, not as far as Brentwood.
I know where it is.
Yeah. And you could go past it a million times, never know it's there. But it's quite a large cemetery. Mm-hmm. And I guess when that was established, there was nothing much, you know, around there. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, the whole story of the cemeteries.
It sure would make a good story.
Yeah.
Because...
It is. I would like to...
Write it. It needs something.
I'd like to... Well, it takes a lot of research, yeah.
I know that. Yeah. This guy, Benny Brith, that I mentioned, I can't think of his name. He's in touch with these little cemeteries along here.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the same guy.
He's the last guy who would have the information.
Yeah. I have his name written down.
Good story. Because a lot of the people living here, the present day people like me, have backgrounds that go to those little cemeteries, and I don't even know where the hell most of them are.
I wonder if the Jewish archives are being put together at the Historical Society. Are you
familiar? Yeah, I know of it. I know.